This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online through the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at SevillePodcast.com. For more radio shows, lectures, and features, visit SevillePodcast.com. And now, here's Coy Barefoot.
Bob Gibson is the political reporter for the Charlottesville Daily Progress. He joins us on Monday afternoons with just a chit-chat about politics, and what a week this is going to be. I'm already ready to make the popcorn and get the soda pop and put my butt in front of the TV and sit there for hours tomorrow night.
Tomorrow should be fun. Tomorrow's probably the last major primary on both sides. It looks like John McCain will wrap it up in Texas against Mike Huckabee. And there's a chance that the Barack Obama-Hillary Clinton showdown will end tomorrow, although that's not at all certain.
The primaries tomorrow, we're looking at Texas, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Vermont, right?
Right.
And, let's do the little ones first. Vermont.
Vermont is the only sure winner in the whole pile, and that one is going to go to Barack Obama.
Okay, because he's polling so far ahead there right now.
Right. It appears that he has a substantial lead in Vermont. The rest of the polling shows races that are almost too close to call. They're within the margin of error. We're going to try to talk about them, but nobody's too sure. I mean, she could take the big states and Rhode Island. She could lose the big states and Rhode Island.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what happens if they just split them?
Well, if they split them...
Like if he takes Texas and she takes Ohio or vice versa...
Then he maintains a rather sizable lead in elected delegates, and there'll be a lot of pressure on Hillary Clinton to drop out of the presidential race before the Pennsylvania primary around the 22nd of April. I would guess that if she splits the two big states tomorrow, that there will be a great deal of pressure applied on Hillary Clinton because she can't possibly close that gap of 150-some delegates, elected delegates. Now, it's closer on when you throw in the superdelegates, but the superdelegates can always switch, and some of them are already switching. Half a dozen of them have pretty much indicated they're switching from her to him.
Yeah, and you don't want to go into the final stages here saying that the only way I can win is to get these superdelegates, because that's...
Well, that would upset a lot of people in the party, and that would make the Denver convention risky for the Democratic Party, for the nominee, for... anyone running on a Democratic ticket anywhere in the country, the party could fall apart if he goes into the convention with a sizable lead among elected delegates, and then she goes in with a sizable lead and takes the nomination through the superdelegates. That would be a recipe for disaster for the Democratic Party.
We're talking with Bob Gibson of the Charlottesville Daily Progress. Big primaries tomorrow, folks. Big Ohio, Texas, Rhode Island, and Vermont. Do you see her just turning and walking away and bowing out, though? I mean, it's going to have to be an orchestrated exit, right?
I think it'll take her a while, unless she wins big tomorrow. It'll take her a while to figure out that she should, you know, go back to the Senate.
Yeah.
I think there is a substantial chance that she takes one of the big states and loses the other. If she loses both, I think she's out. And everybody knows that, and she will eventually acknowledge that. If she loses one and wins one, say she wins Ohio and he wins Texas, which within the margins, that's the way the small leads are in those states right now, she could hang on until Pennsylvania.
And just keep throwing mud at him, which is what she certainly has been doing for at least the last week.
Oh, yeah. She's been running around saying, A good speech. What's that worth?
Yeah,
you know, can't answer a phone well at 3 a.m. if all you do is give a good speech.
Or he's a Christian, as far as I know.
You know, a friend of mine who's way, way, way up in the Democratic Party said the Clintons are known for when the rubber meets the road, they fight hard.
And dirty.
And they throw stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And they have their friends throw stuff. And the stuff isn't always necessarily what you might believe.
Yeah, it is amazing. And what's even more I don't know, and I don't really have a dog in this race, to be honest with you, but it's just amazing to watch the Clinton campaign making these, oh my gosh, these scandals with Canada, and what did they say to Canada, and just stuff that at the end of the day, I think most voters are like, I don't really care. I care about what's going on in Iraq. I care about health care. I care about our economy. It just seems like, I guess it's just so obviously just negative campaigning by somebody who's way behind.
Well, she cut that ad, which I think showed that she was behind, that came out Friday in Ohio, basically saying, you know, your children are asleep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. A phone rings in the White House. Who do you want to answer the phone? Who is going to be prepared on day one when that phone call comes at 3 a.m. in the White House? And I don't think she was ready for his answer. I don't think she figured that Barack Obama within 12 hours would have another ad cooked up, which would use the same beginning of the ad.
Yeah, it's almost the same ad.
It, you know, your children are asleep. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. A phone rings in the White House. And then his response ad says, judgment. You want somebody with judgment, somebody who, on the biggest decision in foreign policy in our lifetime, you know, made the right call on Iraq. So I think he was prepared to come back. And he shifted the debate a bit from, you know, the economic issues where seemingly she has a case to make in Ohio, to foreign policy where, you know, on the war, a lot of Democrats agree with him.
Yeah, really fascinating stuff. And you got to give his team credit. He, I don't know who he's got working for him, but
he's got a great campaign.
He's got obviously got some good speechwriters and some folks who really know what they're doing.
His campaign has impressed many, many people who did not expect him to be as far ahead as he is right now. And he's really substantially ahead of her in elected delegates.
Right. Now, on the right, John McCain looks like he's locked this up, and yet Mike Huckabee's still out having a great time.
Well, Mike Huckabee picked up an endorsement from the Dallas Morning News over the weekend. A lot of conservative Republicans, McCain hasn't made the sale with them yet. He's gaining, he points out, he's gaining the percentage of conservative identifying Republicans that he gets every primary. So I think eventually they will, you know, end up in his camp. But he doesn't have them all yet. There are a lot of them that are still wary of him.
Yeah. And going very reluctantly. I'm related to some, and they're moving over to him quite reluctantly.
Yeah.
You know, I know my sister voted for Romney, and she can't stand McCain, but she said, look, I'll vote for him. I'll hold my nose and vote for him.
Well, there wasn't the perfect conservative candidate this year. I mean, the Republican Party has too many fissures right now, and there was no candidate who could appeal to all the various conservative Republican interest groups.
Bob Gibson is the political reporter for the Charlottesville Daily Progress. He joins us on Monday afternoons. What is where should we start with Virginia politics?
Well, it's warming up in Richmond.
It is indeed.
It was 70 degrees when I left the Holy City, as they refer to themselves, at 3 o'clock this afternoon. And it was warming up inside the Capitol as well, because they aren't as close to wrapping things up as they thought they were last week. The Virginia Supreme Court came down with an opinion 7-0 on Friday that basically threw out nearly half of the revenue that they were expecting to collect from House Bill 3202, the big transportation compromise
from
that
last year,
adopted last April.
Yeah.
So 11 months in, you know, the Democratic leader of the Senate last year, Dick Sasslaw, said it was unconstitutional. The chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, who was retiring, John Chichester, said it was unconstitutional.
This aspect of that transportation
package. The part of the transportation package that was overturned that gave unelected regional authorities taxing powers. That isn't in the Virginia Constitution. And Bob Marshall, a delegate from Manassas, said this is unconstitutional and I'm going to take it to court. And darn if he didn't win 7-0. So the House and the Senate are standing around now with a big hole in 40-some-odd% of their transportation compromise. And they're wondering, well, where do we get the revenue?
Bob, this is huge news, because that's all we heard last year is we're going to fix transportation. We got the abusive driver fees that just fell apart. And then another huge, as you say, almost half of the plan was these we'll create these regional authorities, and they'll just that way we won't have to have like a statewide gas tax. We'll have an authority in Northern Virginia and one in Hampton Roads. They can do their own taxes.
And the Hampton Roads authority was controversial enough that they put off the taxing until April. So it got ruled unconstitutional, but it hadn't started taxing yet. The one in Northern Virginia, they went ahead with it, and the local governments, some of them bought in, some of them didn't, but basically this unelected transportation authority, regional authority that was ruled not to have taxing powers, now has money that probably has to be given back to taxpayers.
Oh, my gosh.
So they have a real mess on their hands when it comes to transportation funding, and they don't have an easy way out.
And the Senate, of course, the Democratic-controlled Senate proposed an increase in the gas tax.
And that was shot down in the House. The House is not about to agree to a 5 cent or more increase in the state gasoline tax. That's just a non-starter in the House of Delegates.
So what did they do? I mean, this is really amazing. Well, and the cover of the Progress today talks about the fact that there's just no money for roads around here.
Road construction money is drying up. More and more of it is going into maintenance, and the construction part of the budget is going to dry up within about 6 or 7 years. So it looks like they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to go into a special session, and that is still something that they're talking about, or they're going to extend this session. Or the most unrealistic of the options is to try to get it all done by Saturday when this session is over, theoretically, and you know, say they have it solved by Saturday and we all go home. Well, that's probably not going to happen. So either what I think they're going to do is pass a budget or try to pass a budget by Saturday and then either continue this session for transportation, but not immediately. You know, they'll have pro forma sessions for a while where they just call everybody. You know, the House of Delegates is now in session. Nobody here. We'll come back tomorrow. That kind of thing until they get a compromise worked out. Or they'll allow the governor to call a special session or ask the governor to call a special session. And that's a matter of debate, you know, who calls it under what circumstances.
Right. And this is what happened last year, right? They finished everything but transportation.
We have special sessions every other year in Virginia. We can't get our work done on time in Richmond.
But there is really, if you think about it, there is no money. You could say, well, we'll move the money from here to over here. There is no money.
No.
For roads.
They do have about half of the package that they passed last year. A lot of it is bonded indebtedness. So they, you know.
So they're borrowing, yeah.
Yeah, they're borrowing and using that money for road construction. That part of it is still intact. There are a few other sources of income that were written into House Bill 3202 last year that are still constitutional, and they can still collect some money. So they've got maybe 60% of their money, but they don't have nearly enough for the minimum that they acknowledge is the state's transportation need package.
Which, right or left, is recognized as a core responsibility of government.
Yeah, but they're not saying which government. They're sort of saying, well, maybe the localities. Maybe the localities have a role to play here since they can legally pass taxes, and we don't want to pass tax increases. Maybe we can get these localities in Northern Virginia and Tidewater, Hampton Roads, to pony up. Well, that's going to be real popular with those elected officials.
Yeah, but that is that anti-tax approach to government that the Republicans in the House have. They're not against somebody else taxing.
No.
They just don't want
to. They don't want to be the ones to press the green light button on a tax increase.
Right. But they'll almost force localities in a position where they have to.
And that's what Ken Stolle, who's the longtime now state senator from Virginia Beach, was saying after this ruling came down 7-0 from the state Supreme Court last Friday. He was saying, well, the reason this came about is because we were trying to be too cute to avoid a tax increase.
Right. Fascinating. It really is amazing. And we certainly haven't heard the last of this. Real quick, we have some time left. Can you talk about your column in yesterday's Progress? About this very issue of politics in Richmond.
Well, part of it is part of the column and part of the problem in Richmond right now is that it's gotten more partisan. Year after year, Richmond more and more resembles Washington in terms of the partisanship of the place. It used to be in Richmond, you couldn't tell too many of the Democrats from too many of the Republicans, and they all seem to, at times, be able to cooperate. Now there's much more party line whipping going on, and that's now true in both houses. Now that the Democrats hold a very narrow 21-19 majority in the Virginia Senate, it's been true for a while, but it's more true now in the House of Delegates, where the Republican majority has shrunk to a 55 out of 100 majority. So it looks like the place is just falling more and more into partisan lines when it comes to these big issues like transportation funding. And, you know, last year's package was put together basically by the Republicans in the House in cooperation with the Republicans in the Senate. They had a hard time agreeing, but they finally did. They did it because they thought, well, we can't get our guys reelected if we don't do something about transportation. They didn't do it in bringing everybody to the table. They basically said, here's our compromise, Republicans in the House, Republicans in the Senate. We'll let the governor weigh in. The governor changed it a bunch, and that brought a lot of Democrats on board. And then they passed this, you know, Rube Goldberg thing. Now two major pieces of it have fallen off. So it's directly related to the lack of bipartisanship, the lack of a bipartisan spirit that it seems to be missing more and more down in Richmond these days.
In so many ways, they're just not doing what a government of the people in a free society is supposed to be doing.
Well, they're looking more and more like the Congress. And I don't know whether they're doing that consciously. I mean, some of the rules they borrowed in the House this year actually were borrowed from the Congress. They were strange to Virginia, but they were not strange to Congress. So, you know, Virginia is not the place that has this peaceful, you know, work together legislature. Not that it was ever, you know, idyllic.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there was always one side that held dominance. And sometimes the minority was very, very poorly treated. So you can't, you know, say that the minorities are any worse treated.
Yeah.
What you can say is that more people are sort of whipped to fall into partisan lines on more things.
We're talking with Bob Gibson of the Charlottesville Daily Progress. You can read his work in the paper and online at dailyprogress.com. You can find a link to his blog there as well on the Daily Progress homepage. Really quick, Bob Marshall's been making news lately. You were talking about how it was his case.
He won the state Supreme Court case 7-0 against the transportation authorities, the regional taxing authorities in Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads. He had a press conference today at which he appeared with a University of Mary Washington student and a George Mason University student who are part of Concealed Carry on Campus, which is a student organization that wants students to be able to take, if they're 21, and have a concealed carry permit. So they've been through the training and they have had a background check, be able to carry a gun on campus. Most of the campuses in Virginia, most of the colleges basically say, no, you can't bring a gun on campus if you're a college student or faculty or administrator. But you know, the odd part is that anyone else with a concealed carry permit can bring a gun on campus concealed. It's only the employees and the students who are forbidden by the universities right now. So Bob Marshall's trying to say, you know, they won't even consider my bill to let administrators and professors, and Todd Gilbert's trying to say they won't even consider my bill to let students carry concealed.
Bob Gibson with the Charlottesville Daily Progress. Thank you, Bob, so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To participate in the program, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, sevillepodcast.com.